When Medicare was created back in 1965, approximately 8% of our population was 65 or older. Current projections, however, estimate that by 2050, that number will rise to 20%, or some 88 million adults. Who will care for our elderly? And how will we be able to afford the $1.2 trillion doctor's bill? In the new book, Curing Medicare, A Doctor's View on How Our Healthcare System is Failing Older Americans and How We Can Fix It, Dr. Andy Lazarus offers both diagnosis and prescription. As a primary care and geriatric physician, Lazarus has been immersed in the intricacies of Medicare policies and politics for the past 25 years. He currently directs a group practice in Columbia, Maryland, and is medical director of several assisted living facilities and retirement communities. Again, the name of the book is Curing Medicare, and we welcome Dr. Andy Lazarus to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's great being here.
What brought you to want to explore the history of Medicare and what we could do to fix it?
Interestingly, I studied the history of Medicare when I was a college student. It was part of my thesis, and since then I've always been interested in Medicare, and it's just good luck that I happen to be living under the Medicare system now because I'm a geriatric doctor. So I've been practicing medicine for about 25 years, and as I watch the Medicare system, how it incentivizes and disincentivizes patients from doing certain things, how it pays physicians, and certainly some of the reforms that are being enacted now, I just felt compelled to look more into it and to put my two cents into the discussion about what was going on in Medicare now.
There are some projections that the next generation or the generation after, that we're looking at some 20% of our population who could be on Medicare.
The population is growing exponentially. And look, let's give Medicare a lot of credit because these are people who would not have been insured were it not for Medicare. And Medicare is a very good and thorough insurance. So it's doing a lot of good for people. The problem is the way it's set up, it's based on a 1965 model. And in our generation now, there are a lot more tests and procedures. There's a lot more hospitalization. There are many, many more specialists. And unfortunately, Medicare hasn't changed to accommodate these changes. So yeah, we're talking a lot of older people. And given the expense that each patient puts into Medicare, we're looking at a system that's bound to go bankrupt unless some changes are made.
So you like the idea. What went wrong with it then?
Yeah, I know. I think the idea is terrific. When you look at 1965, you're looking at an era where there were no MRI machines, CAT scans. There were few hospitals. You had diagnoses that were not around then. In fact, there was nothing that we called Alzheimer's disease in 1965. You had specialists that were low in number. Most of the doctors people saw were primary care doctors. You had families who were able to take care of a lot of the older people as they aged, and they kept them at home most of the time. So as all that's changed, the expense has accelerated without any increase in real quality of care, and Medicare hasn't adjusted to the times. I think that's probably the biggest problem, and I think it's really easy to do. It's something that should happen. Unfortunately, Medicare is a political animal, so every time someone suggests a change, one side or the other of the political aisle makes a stink about it and says they're trying to hurt old people. That's been the biggest barrier. So I do think changes can be made, and as a practicing doctor rather than an academic doctor who lives in Medicare all the time, I felt that I should at least give my two cents about which changes I thought were very easy to do and which would benefit doctors and patients and save the system a tremendous amount of money.
I want to get to some of those suggestions in a moment. One of the most telling things to me, though, in the book is that you talk about, as you say, you are a practicing doctor, you are in these assisted living facilities, and you instruct your nurses and your staff to do whatever you can to keep patients out of the hospital. That says a lot to me. So what is the thought process behind that?
Not only do I suggest that to the nurses, but the nurses and the aides instinctively know that as well. In fact, most patients and their families do not want to go to the hospital. About 80% of people say they prefer not to. And in my experience, that's probably a low number. The reason is when older people go to the hospital, several things can happen. First of all, there's over-treatment. They're met with a lot of specialists and a lot of tests, and sometimes they could be given medicines that are dangerous. They could be overloaded with fluid. Their hands could be tied down. They could get infections that they wouldn't otherwise get. And most people with dementia who go to the hospital come back much worse mentally and functionally than they were before they went. We also know that the hospital does not provide better care than just treating at home or in an assisted living facility. For most conditions, it's been shown that the care actually is better if you just keep people home. So it's safer to stay home. People with dementia are in an environment that they know, with caregivers that they know. And even people without dementia, it's just the familiar surroundings are much more amenable to get better. And staying away from this aggressive onslaught of medicine that's in the hospital now is the best thing for most older people. And I say most because there are situations where the hospital is absolutely necessary. If you break a hip, if your appendix ruptures, you have to go to the hospital. But the vast majority of conditions I see are much better served by people staying right where they are.
Dr. Andy Lazarus is our guest. The name of the book is Curing Medicare, A Doctor's View on How Our Healthcare System is Failing Older Americans and How We Can Fix It. You have a study here that estimates some 30,000 elderly Americans die each year due to excessive care. What is excessive care? When do we go overboard?
We go overboard far too often, and that 30,000 is probably a low ball figure. Example of excessive care is someone goes into the hospital a little bit confused, and they send them in because of the confusion. They hook them up to an IV, which gives intravenous fluid. The intravenous fluid floods their veins and puts them into congestive heart failure. They then go into an intensive care unit, and then they end up getting antibiotics and fluid medicines. They have a catheter put in, and in the end, the infections and the fluid overload are what kill them. Whereas they went in for a minor illness that was not worthy of hospitalization and that would have probably resolved on its own. That's a large level of excessive care. Even the amount we treat blood pressure, we often over-treat blood pressure and diabetes. We put people on 15 to 20 medicines that can cause them to be weak, to fall down, to have memory problems. So we are famous for over-treating people. You know, we just think there's a treatment for everything, and we should put everyone on every treatment. And unfortunately, as that number and many others have shown, we're actually doing people a disservice at very high cost to the system, too.
My father passed away at the age of 86, and at the time of his death, when we were cleaning out the home, the family home, we realized that at the time of his death, he was on 26 prescription medications. And this was for a guy who, except for being 86, was by all means healthy. How does that happen, and who ultimately looks over that to tap you on the shoulder and say, wow, that's a lot of medicine?
We as doctors have to bear the ultimate responsibility. A lot of people will say the drug companies are pushing their medicines on TV and ads, but we're the ultimate arbiters of whether a medicine is useful or not, and it's really up to us to discuss with a patient the pros and cons of a medicine and let the patient make a decision. What happens far too often is, I don't know if this was the case with your dad at all, but people go to a lot of specialists, and I'm not sure if your dad did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those specialists are very focused on one organ.
Right.
So you might go to a cardiologist who will look at blood pressure, look at cholesterol, put them on blood thinners. You could walk out of a cardiologist's office on six medicines. Now, those medicines might hurt the kidney, might make you more tired, might make you more likely to fall, might give you muscle aches, but that's really not the cardiologist's concern. And then you'll go to the next doctor who will do the same thing, and soon enough you're on 26 medicines. And these medicines are all interacting with each other. And what they're the actual benefit of almost all interventions in the elderly is so tiny. It's something I talk about in this book, and I use graphs of a 1,000-person theater to just show how many people benefit from many of these medicines. And most medicines, it's between 1 and 5 out of 1,000 people might benefit, if that. And if we keep adding them on, the side effects accentuate. So who should make the decision ultimately to start taking medicines off is, you know, to me, it is the primary care doctor. Unfortunately, many primary care doctors will try to do that, but the patients will say, well, my heart doctor gave me this, my lung doctor gave me this, my stomach doctor gave me this, and it's kind of untouchable. You know, we're left with a lot of doctors giving treatments that we know are potentially harmful. And that's the problem with a society where 80% of doctors are specialists. There are very few of us and a lot of them, and they are the ones who are really running the show these days.
You know, anecdotally, when I tell the story occasionally about the 26 medications, I've heard people say, you know, I realized my mother was on, and when she was in her 80s, and I realized she was on 20 medications, and I just opened up a drawer, shoved them all in there, and we just sort of started from scratch.
I think that's a great idea. Yeah.
Okay. That's the thing.
It happens a lot.
So how do you do that? I mean, ultimately, I'm going to get to asking you the question of what we do about all this. So if they don't go to a hospital and we keep them away, if we keep the elderly away from specialists, they still require medical care. So where do they go? How do they get it? And then how is that kind of streamlined so there isn't this excessive care?
I really think the primary care doctor is in the ultimate position to provide 95% of the care an elderly person needs, because we look at the whole patient. And so we might look at a cholesterol medicine. We're graded as doctors whether our patients are on cholesterol medicine. If we don't put them on, we actually get a bad grade from Medicare. But cholesterol medicines can cause leg weakness, leg pain, fatigue, sometimes in almost 50% of people who use them. And if you look at the benefits of cholesterol medicine in the elderly, there's the only study that's been done shows the average length of life it's saved is 6 days for an average person. So unless those are really good 6 days, you know, when I talk to a patient, they'll look at those numbers and they'll say, you know what, let's try off these medicines. So we will do trial and error. We'll take off some blood pressure medicines and let the blood pressure run a little higher. And a lot of older people need higher blood pressure because their arteries are narrow and they just need some pressure to get through those blocked arteries. Every single person is different, and when you're dealing with the elderly, you can't just have a formula that you use. And I think primary care doctors know that. And if we're left to our own devices and we can have conversations with our patients and their families, most people want to get off these medicines. Most people realize that they're not causing a lot of benefit and that they're causing harm. And once we have that conversation, it's actually pretty easy to get people off medicine. I can't tell you the number of people that get better. I mean, the most telling thing is when someone goes on hospice and they're on 26 medicines, and then all of a sudden all the medicines are stopped because they're supposed to be at the end of life, and they get better, and they get released from hospice. We knew it. The problem was the medicines. And too many times after that, the families will come up to me and say, well, now that they're better, should we restart the medicines? There's just this belief that we can intervene and make a difference, and often we're doing just the opposite.
The name of the new book is Curing Medicare by Dr. Andy Lazarus. Dr. Lazarus is a primary care physician specializing in geriatrics and currently directs a group practice in Columbia, Maryland. So as we've been talking, you have put a lot of the pressure, if you will, on the shoulders of the primary care physician. And I'm curious as to, so if we do this, if we go to the primary care, our primary care physician, if we try to avoid the hospitals, how ultimately does that address what you look at in this book of curing Medicare? How much is it on that system to cure itself, or does it really have to come from that, from the doctor level?
I think the doctor is incredibly important in this, in initiating the conversation. Unless you have a doctor who's willing to engage in shared decision-making and not engage in protocol medicine. Protocol medicine meaning there's a right answer and a wrong answer. There's a right blood pressure and a wrong blood pressure. But shared decision-making, like we talked about, where we talk about the pros and cons, I think that would go a long way to helping people not get excessive care. And when you don't get excessive care and you're not running to the hospital all the time, that'll save the system a lot of money. But remember, we have a system in Medicare that is encouraging excessive care, and that is also encouraging people to go to the hospital. It's far cheaper for a patient to be treated in the hospital for the patient's sake than to be treated at home. If a patient's treated at home, that patient has to pay for any extra care they need, any medicines they need, most equipment that they need. They don't have a benefit of rehabilitation after they're sick. Whereas if they go to the hospital, all that is paid for, and they get 100 days of rehabilitation paid for by Medicare. So the system is fighting against this idea that, you know, keeping people home is a good idea. You know, the system pushes them in, and also the system pays certain specialist doctors a lot of money to do procedures. You know, a person who puts in a stent is going to make as much money doing one stent as a primary care doctor will make in a day of seeing patients. So, you know, that's a system that can be fixed tomorrow. You know, we could change those rules. All those rules are not part of the free market. They come from Medicare. And by changing those rules, we could start moving medicine in a much more beneficial direction.
Is that why, for most of us, and I know this was the case with my parents in their elder years, which was you would call up for the appointment to go see the specialist because something was going on with the heart, something was going on here, and you were concerned, and they can't see you until 5 months from now, and they tell you to go to the hospital. They tell you to go to the emergency room. So how do we avoid that? Because just getting in to see that doctor again and to have that 10, 15 minutes that you had a month ago when the prescription was originally prescribed, well, how do you get back? And isn't that part of the problem?
Well, we certainly, you know, in my community, seeing a specialist is not that difficult. Seeing a primary care doctor is incredibly difficult because there are very few of us who take Medicare now, and there are very few of us to begin with. And we don't have enough. You know, we have nurse practitioners in our practice who are excellent, and they look at patients holistically. They're naturally inclined to do shared decision making. They're averse to the hospital, and they probably do more than anyone to help keep people out. So ultimately, we're going to have to expand the primary care pool, both through nurse practitioners and through training more primary care doctors. Again, this is something that can happen tomorrow. Medicare pays for residency training slots. That's where doctors get trained to be specialists or primary care doctors. And they certainly tomorrow could say, well, we're going to pay for a lot more primary care slots and a lot fewer specialist slots. And it'll happen immediately because they have the purse. So again, the solution's there. We need more primary care. And so if someone is having a problem and they call a doctor or practice, they should be able to be seen right away and avoid the hospital. Hopefully to see a primary care doctor. And then if the primary care doctor needs a specialist in consultation, then that can happen. But again, we have a lot of data that show that areas of the country that are heavy in specialist concentration, there's more hospitalization, there's higher cost, and there's worse outcome. And those have been consistent studies. Areas with high primary care concentration, that's not the case. So our ultimate goal is to get more primary care and to have access, like you say.
You write in the book that you supported the Affordable Care Act, but you also make the point that you believe that the regulations are strangling geriatric care. How so?
You know, in the same way I support Medicare, and Hillary Clinton has a plan to expand Medicare to age 50. I support anything that's going to give people more health insurance because ultimately, health care is a right, and no one should have to suffer without health insurance. So the Affordable Care Act, on one hand, did a lot to expand health care insurance. On the other hand, with that expansion came regulations, and those regulations are very difficult for primary care doctors because they require excessive amounts of paperwork to do even simple items like getting someone a wheelchair. The things that would keep people out of the hospital are becoming much more difficult. They also are grading us based on whether we follow protocols. So everything we talked about shared decision-making is being shunned by the new regulations. There's a list of protocols you're supposed to follow for every person, and that's ingrained in the Affordable Care Act and in most of the Medicare reforms that are being implemented now. So to me, that goes the wrong direction. Unfortunately, the Affordable Care Act came with that baggage. It's not necessarily baggage that has to stick around, but I think it was part of the political nature of that act. People wanted accountability, So to them, accountability was make sure the doctors have quality care. And they, the way they assess quality care is, are we keeping blood pressure below X? Are they on cholesterol medicines? Have they had a mammogram? You know, things that, that matter less to most people than, you know, actually taking care of them and what their needs are. And none of that is assessed. And that all is compromised because we have to spend so much time checking the boxes with these protocols. So that part of the Affordable Care Act and the excessive regulations for paperwork are aspects that really should be changed.
You talked about a moment ago that in your community that primary care doctors are at a premium. Why do you believe that is the case, especially ones who will take Medicare? And what can we do about that problem to have more primary care doctors, one, and two, more primary care doctors like yourself who specialize in geriatrics?
I think, you know, a lot of primary care doctors are doing what's called concierge medicine. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they charge patients $1,500, $2,000 a year, and they have smaller patient pools. And that does two things for them. Number one, they can have a smaller number of patients, and they can spend much more time with each patient. And number two, they're not burdened by a lot of these onerous regulations and paperwork requirements and computer requirements that are coming down from insurance. So you're losing a lot of primary care doctors that way, too. You also are not having as many medical students going to primary care because although primary care doctors make a fine living, they are well compensated, in my opinion, the compensation for specialists is just so much higher. And, you know, twice the amount. And specialists have a very, you know, focused job. You know, they do procedures and they take care of one area of the body where primary care doctors have to take care of an entire patient, and, you know, it's very difficult for a lower fee. So when people are in medical school, they tend to go the other direction. They're also trained mostly by specialists, and, you know, there's really no incentive for them to go into primary care. Again, that could be reversed by just having Medicare say it's going to train X number of primary care doctors and fewer specialists. And also, Medicare is completely in control of how much doctors get paid. There is a small committee in the American Medical Association, mostly made up of specialists, that determines how much doctors are going to get paid. They come to their conclusions every year. Medicare adopts the conclusions. Most other insurances follow suit. And so that's why people who put in a cardiac stent are making as much with one stent as doctors seeing patients all day. That's not the free market deciding that. That's some committee in the AMA. So, again, that could change tomorrow. So we can get more primary care doctors very easily if Medicare made tiny pivots in the way they pay people and the way they train doctors.
Okay, so final question. Where does your optimism lie when it comes to these changes, especially since you have noted a few times that they can happen overnight?
Yeah, I really think if we can get the right people to listen, then what actually the changes would do would be to increase patients' ability to get what they want, increase quality and lower cost. And so we just need to have people listen. That my pessimism comes that there are a lot of entrenched interests that are opposed to those changes, from hospitals to pharmaceutical companies to specialist doctors. I mean, they don't want these changes. So they are banging on Congress's door to make sure they don't happen. So as with everything, that is the most difficult part of getting common sense change implemented. But there are a lot more people now talking about this. So I do have some optimism that as Medicare is collapsing financially, we're going to have to do something. And we should do something that makes sense and that's easy to do. And to me, that's this approach.
The name of the book is Curing Medicare, A Doctor's View on How Our Healthcare System is Failing Older Americans and How We Can Fix It. The book is published by Cornell University Press. Dr. Andy Lazarus, I thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much. Good talking to you.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Curing Medicare by Andy Lazarus. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.